From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. While the Trump administration tries to contain the spread of coronavirus inside the White House, officials are also trying to contain the fear that the pandemic is doing lasting damage to the U.S. economy. This morning on Fox News, White House economic advisor Peter Navarro argued too much attention was being paid to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin's comments yesterday that unemployment may have already reached 25%, comparable to the 1930s.
This Great Depression pity party stuff I saw yesterday, this ain't that. And we got a great president here who built up this economy once, and he can do it again and will do it again.
Let's bring in Domenico Montanaro, NPR senior political editor and correspondent, for more. And Domenico, Democrats and Republicans seem to be on very different pages about passing something like another relief package to help boost the economy. Does it look like we'll see one anytime soon?
Well, you never know, but there's no rush, it seems, to do that on the White House's part. Economic advisor Kevin Hassett, in fact, this weekend said on CNN that it's premature to go in on another big package. He said that the country has, quote, the luxury of a moment right now to wait and see what's needed as the rest of the earlier packages start to take effect. He said the administration should be, quote, prudent going forward. You know, it's possible that there's more of a V-like recovery than past recoveries, because most employers are saying that they will hire people back, but not all are going to do so. And that's going to leave some people out in the cold. And this is the highest unemployment rate we've seen since the Great Depression.
Yeah. You know, the president and vice president Pence are not self-quarantining, even though a member of each of their staffs have tested positive for COVID-19. All of this is impacting the particulars of a congressional hearing that's supposed to be scheduled for tomorrow. What's the latest there?
Well, pretty ironically, this hearing is called COVID-19 Safely Getting Back to Work and Back to School. And yet it's going to take place via video conference because three of the key doctors who are going to be testifying are self-quarantining because of contact with this White House staffer. And the chairman of the committee, the Republican Lamar Alexander, is self-quarantining because someone on his staff tested positive for COVID-19. So this is a key hearing. We have some of the top people involved, including Drs. Anthony Fauci of NIH, Robert Redfield, who's in charge of the CDC, and Richard Hahn, who heads up the FDA. But they're going to be doing it remotely because of what's been happening and the contact that they've had with people who've tested positive.
On Twitter this morning, President Trump accused Democrats of slowly moving to lift social distancing restrictions for, quote, political purposes. And you've actually written about this.
Well, Trump's in recent days downplayed the importance of testing, saying that it makes the U.S. look bad. He thinks that Democrats don't want the country to open more quickly because the economy will hurt him for re-election. Polls are showing that more people are worried about opening too early rather than being too slow. But he clearly has a focus on how this is going to make him look and whether or not he can win re-election in this kind of environment. And it's really fascinating. We've never seen this kind of campaigning that's going to have to take place in November.
That's Domenico Montanaro. He's NPR senior political editor and correspondent. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, today, barbershops and salons in much of Florida can reopen after some restaurants and stores got the green light to resume business last week. Florida has so far reported fewer than 1,800 deaths, about a third as many as Michigan. But the Miami Herald reports the state may be withholding data on who has died from COVID-19. Nicholas Nehemas is an investigative reporter for the Herald. Nicholas, what information are you getting about COVID-19 deaths, and what's the problem?
So after weeks of delay, the state again started providing to us a list of all COVID-19 deaths in Florida. This list is collected from the county medical examiners. But the problem with the list that was released to us is that two columns which described how the people died and their probable cause of death were completely redacted from the document. Now, that's something that the chief medical examiner said the state has never done before. It's been releasing this list since after Hurricane Andrew, and it's just very unclear why the state, kind of out of the blue, is trying to redact this information and prevent the public from understanding, you know, how and why Floridians are dying. Now, I should say that the state failed to properly redact the document, so we do have access to the underlying reports, but their intention was to withhold that information from the public.
that was their intention, that Governor DeSantis was involved in this and telling examiners to keep some information secret?
It certainly came from Governor DeSantis's administration, and they were, you know, going around even to individual county medical examiners saying, do not release this information. And the county attorneys, including here in Miami-Dade County, said it's a public record. We have to release it under the law.
There are big questions about what has happened and what is going to happen in Florida, because, of course, many beaches have already reopened and allowed people to go back to them, even as case numbers continue to climb. Are there certain groups of people in the numbers, such as tourists or snowbirds, who are being counted differently when it comes to deaths in Florida?
So they at first were being counted by medical examiners, but not by the state, the Department of Health. The Department of Health has started counting them. But, you know, the concern you bring up, I think, is one that a lot of people have. I mean, Florida, 1,800 people roughly have died. There have been tens of thousands of cases, but Florida has managed to keep this pandemic more under control than other states, you know, thanks in part to a lot of the local and state stay-at-home orders. And so, you know, epidemiologists are worried that there will be a renewed spike as the state starts to open back up again. And, you know, that concern has to be weighed against the damage to the economy that's been done.
Do you think that deaths are being underestimated in Florida right now?
That's a really good question. In other states, you know, we've seen a lot of excess deaths, as they're called, you know, people that you wouldn't expect to die compared to previous years who are dying, and it's not being attributed to COVID-19. We haven't seen that as obviously in Florida, although scientists who study this tell us there could be a data reporting issue in Florida and other states, that they're simply not reporting the data about deaths as fast as some other states, you know, in the Northeast.
By the way, Nicholas, you're joining us from Miami Beach, and we can hear a little bit of activity behind you, but Miami Beach is still pretty much shut down right now, correct?
Yes, completely. I mean, there's takeout available, but, you know, the beaches are closed. All non-essential businesses are closed. People are wearing face masks pretty much everywhere.
That is Nicholas Nehamas, who is an investigative reporter at the Miami Herald. I will link you to his reporting on this at hereandnow.org. Nicholas, thank you.
Thank you.
The Taliban says COVID-19 is spreading throughout crowded jails in Afghanistan, and it's accusing the government of deliberately making inmates sick. This could put at risk a key condition of peace between the U.S. and the Taliban to end years of fighting, and that's a prisoner swap. NPR's Dia Hadid reports.
In a video filmed by a prisoner in a lockup near Kabul, an inmate struggles to breathe. One man asks the other, what's wrong with him? And he says, Corona. There's about 30,000 people in Afghanistan's overcrowded prisons. It's unclear how many are sick. Government spokesman Farhad Bayani says they've tested about 600 inmates and staff, but so far only 10 are positive. But the prisoner who says he filmed that video says three inmates died in his prison. Sayed Maywand Aha says many more have fevers and coughs. He's in Polisharkhi, the country's largest facility. He says there's 20 prisoners in a room meant for 10. You can't even move your feet. He says the prison guards are also sick. In one area, he says so many guards were quarantined that the prisoners walk about freely. The situation inside Afghanistan's prison reflects the situation outside. The country's struggling to cope with the pandemic. Testing rates are really low, and there's concerns the virus is now widely circulating. The health system is battered after decades of war. There's not many doctors, ventilators, or protective gear. And so the Taliban say the prisoners are uniquely vulnerable. And reports that some of them are suffering from COVID-19-like symptoms has angered the insurgents, who have thousands of loyalists in government prisons. Last Friday, they accused the government of deliberately spreading the disease among inmates. Spokesman Zabihullah Mujahid warned they'd take revenge if their prisoners were harmed. Prisoners are a sensitive matter for the Taliban right now, especially since they signed a deal with the United States. That deal called for a swift prisoner swap between the Taliban and the Afghan government. But the exchanges have dragged on. Just over 800 Taliban prisoners have been released. The insurgents expected some 5,000. But spokesman Javed Faisal says the government is moving as swiftly as it can.
To make sure that we control the spread of coronavirus in Afghanistan, mainly in our prisons, and to advance the peace process, the government is committed to releasing prisoners, including the Taliban.
Andrew Watkins is a senior analyst with the International Crisis Group. He says the coronavirus complicates the fragile Afghan peace process, but he says ultimately the Taliban want it to succeed.
This is a really good deal for the Taliban if they can get it to stick, because it does accomplish one of the things they've said they wanted to do for almost 20 years now, kick out the foreign troops.
But if large numbers of Taliban prisoners get very sick or die, that calculus might change. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Islamabad.
Dr. Anthony Fauci will testify before the Senate Health, Education, Labor and Pensions Committee tomorrow about the government's response to the coronavirus. He's doing it by video conference because he and other top health officials are self-isolating after having come in contact with an aide at the White House who's been diagnosed with COVID-19. Even though the format has changed, you can bet that Fauci will once again stick closely to the facts tomorrow. He has often corrected the president, even while standing right next to him. Here he is explaining his philosophy in a congressional hearing earlier this year.
I've served 6 presidents, and I have never done anything other than tell the exact scientific evidence and made policy recommendations based on the science and the evidence.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris joins us now to tell us about Anthony Fauci and how he made a name for himself over 5 decades of public service. Richard, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And how did Fauci become the trusted source of information for coronavirus and many epidemics that came before?
Well, every time a new infectious disease crops up, Tony Fauci is there as the voice of calm and the purveyor of facts. You may have seen him over the years talking about Ebola. I remember his standing in front of the hospital at the National Institutes of Health with a patient who had recovered from this terrifying disease. He was at the same time humanizing the situation as well as calming a nation that was, in truth, overly jumpy about a disease that really had very little impact here. You may also remember him when a previous coronavirus called SARS appeared more than a decade ago, 17 years ago, I guess, or during the Zika virus outbreak or during West Nile disease. You know, it's sort of when you see a nasty disease, you're likely to see Dr. Fauci. But, you know, his reputation really dates back to the 1980s. In fact, during a presidential debate back then, candidate George H.W. Bush was asked to name a hero. Here's what he said.
I think of Dr. Fauci. Probably never heard of him. He's a very fine research top doctor at National Institute of Health, working hard doing something about research on this disease of AIDS.
Interesting. Why do you think Bush picked him at that particular moment when he was asked to name a hero?
Right. Well, Fauci had already established himself as the voice of science, and the voice of science was a trusted voice back then, probably more than it is now. By the late 1980s, he'd already distinguished himself because of his role in the AIDS epidemic. You know, I first met Dr. Fauci back in the early 1980s. I was a reporter in San Francisco covering the emergence of a mysterious disease that was killing primarily gay men. And he really took the lead at the federal level. And this is a time, remember, when the Ronald Reagan administration was really just wanting to ignore a disease that had been called the gay plague. To Fauci, it was no more and no less than another devastating infectious disease. Pressure to do something rose up from the gay community, and Fauci actually didn't shy away from that. He somehow managed to retain the trust of skeptical people in the administration while at the same time he was listening to gay advocates and actually acting on what they were saying. I talked to one of those advocates a few months ago, a man named Peter Staley, and here's what he had to say about Fauci.
I think we can say for sure that he's helped save millions of lives thus far. So it's a remarkable legacy. And if he hadn't been there, the government's response would be very different.
And he says that because Fauci led the push to get new antiviral drugs on the market with remarkable speed. Those first drugs were actually not very good, but Fauci kept pressing. And today, Americans diagnosed with HIV often live a full life.
Richard, you mentioned some of the other major infectious diseases that Fauci has worked on, SARS, Ebola. did dealing with those diseases prepare him for this pandemic, or is it apples and oranges?
No, I think up to a certain extent it did. Obviously, this is a different scale of problem. But, you know, Fauci has always been a tell-it-like-it-is kind of person. And I think that those skills were really honed not only with AIDS, but with all those other diseases you mentioned as well. And, you know, that is really valuable in a public health situation like an epidemic. There are always things we do know, but always a lot of things we don't know when a new disease is spreading. And Fauci realized early on that it is so important to be clear to distinguish between those, offering reassurance, but not false reassurance. And, you know, over the decades, he's built up a huge well of public trust. I should say he's not right 100% of the time. I think it's fair to say that he was surprised to discover just how much this new coronavirus spreads from people who don't show symptoms. And that has unfortunately played a major role in the spread of this disease. But, you know, even though he's had a few missteps, Fauci has maintained his credibility, at least among a broad swath of the public, because he always seems to be calling it like he sees it.
But, you know, when you say a broad swath of the public, there are some people who don't trust Fauci. The president himself even retweeted a Fire Fauci hashtag. Right. Was Fauci ready for the political storm he's in today?
Well, Fauci is in a tough spot, and there's no doubt about it. The president and his supporters are outwardly skeptical about science. They promote dubious ideas like using malaria drugs to treat the coronavirus. And as you said at the top of this, Fauci has on many occasions contradicted the president, even while standing right next to him. But you notice he never says President Trump is wrong. He simply states the correct facts. And early on in the epidemic here, he had very broad public support. But, you know, as this disease gets increasingly politicized, Fauci is seen by some skeptics as the enemy. And that does make him a potential target for a president who is preoccupied with being reelected and seems to be viewing the epidemic largely through that lens. Still, I think it's fair to say that Anthony Fauci is probably the best known and most trusted scientist in the United States right now. And that matters a lot.
That is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Richard, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, pets can be great companions during this stressful time, but their lives have also been altered by stay-at-home orders. So what should we be doing to make sure our dogs and cats are healthy and happy? Joining us now from Chicago by Skype is Steve Dale, who's a certified animal behavior consultant. Steve, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, and I have to say, as a dog owner, I am most excited about the idea that the dog groomers will eventually be able to open in some form, because my dog definitely needs a haircut. What do you say to people out there who are in the same situation? Should they wait it out or try to groom the dog themselves?
You know, it depends. That's one of those state-by-state things. So right now, some states have already opened up where dog groomers are available for you, and the dogs are in desperate need. In other states, it'll be a while. If you know it's going to be a while and you know your dog is really getting to the point where that dog needs a haircut, contact your veterinarian, because some veterinary professionals can give you advice about where to go or at least what to do. Make sure the hair is out of the dog's eyes, because that's not fair, right? Imagine your vision being impaired every day, all day. So if you can do that safely without poking your dog in the eye, that's a thing to do. And also be sure to keep up with brushing of your dog so the hair doesn't get matted in the first place.
As you know, many people are adopting pets during this time. If you get a new puppy right now, and you're in this weird situation where the dog doesn't really get to play with other dogs or see that many other people, is that a problem for a dog, for a puppy?
Yes, potentially, because socialization is so incredibly important. And there's a period of time where there is a window where dogs are sponges and they socialize very easy. And it's very, very important, because without it, we know dogs can develop behavior problems as a result of not being socialized. So let's be creative and find ways to socialize those puppies.
And what about the idea that the dog is at home and there may be a lot of people around all the time? What happens when things get back to normal or different than they are now, and then all of a sudden the dog has separation anxiety? How do you stop that from happening?
Well, I think it's going to happen. I think that's a very good question. And the dogs are with us 24/7, all day, every day. Adoptions are up. Fosters are up. That's great, except we are there all the time with these dogs, who in some cases have never been left alone. So you can start by setting up a camera. They are not expensive. And then go away. Take everyone with you except the dog and see how the dog does being left home alone. Also, leave some treats out. If those treats are not scarfed up, that's a red flag right there for most dogs. If you think your dog may have some difficulties, now is the time to start working on it. There are lots of products available, pheromone products. There's even one that it looks like a little halo, and you hold it over your dog's head, and it actually lowers the anxiety in your dog. There are nutraceutical products available. You can contact your veterinarian and say, what do I do now? Because leaving it alone is the worst thing you can do. The dogs are generally not going to figure out, well, he'll be home, I'll be okay. It actually, left alone, typically gets worse before it gets better.
What about cats? You know, the Wall Street Journal had a very funny little two op-eds, one from a dog, one from a cat. And the dog says, why not work from home forever? And the cat says, America needs to get back to work. Enough is enough. What are cats thinking, and what should you be worried about if you're a cat owner at this time?
You know, the truth of the matter is that, and those of you who have cats know this and understand this. Well, cats are very different than dogs. They love us too. They appreciate the fact that we're there. Now, with the kids there all the time and maybe only paying attention to the cats, that might be a bit too much for some cats. But overall, they appreciate the fact that we are there. The thing is, they may adjust better than dogs when we suddenly go back to the office. And, you know, the dogs aren't getting an email in advance saying this is going to happen 3 weeks from Tuesday.
They
have no way to know what's coming or why it's coming. So I'm more concerned about dogs in that regard.
That is Steve Dale, who is a certified animal behavior consultant. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
With so many people out of work, it's easy to wonder if this moment in time could be our generation's Great Depression. Many economists say no, it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. But it got us wondering how people who actually lived through the Great Depression are processing our current reality. Joining us now is Del Roberson, a retired newspaper publisher from outside of Driftwood, Texas, who was born during the Depression. And he recently wrote a column about how we will all persevere through COVID-19. Dale, welcome.
Thank you.
And Dale, I understand that you're home alone on a big property in the country with your animals. How are you doing?
I'm here with one dog, five cats, and seven donkeys.
Wow. You're pretty busy then.
Well, my grandson bought me enough groceries to get by for the first month that we were going through this. And then I have gone to Sam's a couple of times early in the morning when they're open just for us old folks, and picked up some more groceries, and I have enough groceries to do just fine. The only other thing I do is I do go to the feed store to pick up feed for my animals, mostly for my donkeys.
You know, I want to talk a little bit more about what it was like for you and your family growing up. You were born in 1937, so that's actually on the tail end of the Great Depression. Do you remember what your family did to make ends meet?
Well, my father came off of a farm in Comanche in central Texas, and when he was younger and just out of high school, he and my uncle rode the rods, in other words, a freight train from Texas to California, because they had heard that they could make a living out there. And when they got there, they found out that things weren't so good. But fortunately, FDR had started the Works Projects Administration, and my father and my uncle joined the CCC, the Conservation Corps. And then they came back to Texas and worked in the oil fields. And then World War II started, and I think that pretty much saved us, because so many people went to work in the war effort.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting what you're saying about that, because it's sort of contrasting what we're dealing with now. I mean, now we have government interventions, really, that came through just weeks after COVID-19 began to spread throughout our country. It was a different time then, though. You all were really relying on just the grit of trying to survive. But then, as you said, the war came, and that kind of saved folks because it allowed them to be able to get to work.
Yes, and during the war, we also had Victory Gardens, so we had food. We had some quail and some prairie chickens to eat occasionally. The difference, I think, between now and then, or at least one of the differences, is that we're getting a double whammy now. Not only are we getting a disease that's causing this, it's not the same as the Wall Street crash in 29. This disease is affecting everybody. It's also not only affecting us health-wise, but affecting us money-wise.
Yeah, you wrote a column in your local paper, as I mentioned, the Hayes Free Press, about how in your lifetime, our nation has really overcome a lot. What are some of those moments that you're thinking about today?
Well, my mother told me about the Spanish flu when she was young. She lost twin siblings. But then since then, after the Spanish flu, you know, then we came into the Depression, and of course we had the Dust Bowl and lots of other things. In my lifetime, or the thing that we could compare to this mostly would be the polio epidemic. And I have a cousin who contracted polio, went to the hospital the day after he and I were playing together, and he got polio, and I had a real hard time of it, and he walked with braces and crutches. I also lost a friend. That there was a boy that lived down the block from us that I played baseball with, and then one day I went to his house to see if he could come out and play, and his mother said they'd lost him. So we have been through, America itself has been through many, many things, maybe not comparable to this, but pretty close, and that we always can come through.
You know, so many of us are worried about our parents and grandparents because many of them are, of course, part of this vulnerable population. But in talking to you, what I'm really struck by is just how strong you are, both mentally and it sounds like physically. And so while so many of us, including your children and grandchildren, are worried about you, you kind of have a lot of answers on how we can persevere.
Well, fortunately, I'm in good health, and I stay busy. I have a woodwork shop, and I have my animals, and that's probably the secret to it all. Keep busy and keep a good attitude. So just keep your chin up.
That's Dale Roberson. He's a retired newspaper publisher from outside of Driftwood, Texas, who was born during the Great Depression. And he recently wrote a column about how we will persevere through COVID-19. Dale, thank you so much.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for having me.
Well, since so many of us are stuck at home during the pandemic, it's hard for photographers to document what's going on. But one photographer from Lafayette, Colorado, has been busy capturing images of people at home. You could call them porch portraits. Reporter Sonia Doctorian has the story.
Ready? One, two, three. And one, two, three.
Kate Fisher has been a photographer since she got her first Nikon at age 15. Now, putting her passion to work in the pandemic, she's composed more than 300 front porch portraits, including this couple.
Hello, Carolyn and David. Thanks so much for participating.
Fisher asked residents to write a message to the community and post it with the photograph.
I'm here to timestamp Lafayette. We're all having to be really brave right now.
Fisher says she got the idea after people were told to stay at home.
There was a sense of urgency for me to figure out a way to turn that no into a yes in a very safe and creative way.
Fisher photographs from the street for safety. People fill out a form on Fisher's Timestamp Studios website to set up an appointment. She parks her car and calls Tracy Boy to let her know she's outside. Boy says she loved the idea as soon as she read about the project online.
With some positivity during what seemed like was never-ending negative news.
Boy asked Fisher how she and her dog Leo should pose for their portrait.
You and Leo can maybe sit on your nice steps there. If you want to hold Leo, that's great too. One, two, three. Beautiful.
Kate Fisher feels deep pride in Lafayette, which was founded by Mary Miller in 1888 after coal was discovered on her farm. Miller wanted Lafayette to be a community, not just a mining camp. So she built a school, churches, and homes for miners. Today, Fisher and her family live in one of those modest wood frame miner houses.
Tracy, I live right down the street.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, so I will see you around.
Yeah, well, bye.
All right, cool. Thank you.
Next, Fisher calls Esmeralda Rivera to say she's on her way. Rivera, her two daughters, her niece and nephew cluster on the porch steps around their handwritten sign, their message to the community.
My sign say, believe on the miracle of love.
Little one on the end, can you come a little closer? Awesome. All right, ready? All right, one, two, three.
Rivera's full-time job as a fast food worker has been cut by half. Still, as Fisher turns to leave, Rivera hands her $25 in cash to say thanks. The donation means a lot to Fisher, whose wedding and family photography bookings have been canceled.
Everybody that has been donating to this project to keep it afloat has really helped my wheels continue to turn.
But Fisher's not doing this for an occasional tip. She says she wants to document this time, to pass it on to future generations.
Everything is changing all the time. People, the world, faces, and then look back on it in 10 or 20 years. That's gold to me.
Fisher says what people will see in the future, at least so far, is a lot of smiling for the camera. But
I'm waiting for the one that is like, you know, I'm really having a really hard time with all of this. And to tell you the truth, I don't really know what to do. And then I feel like everyone in the community is going to just flood that picture. And that's going to be so great.
Fisher says so far her timestamp project has consumed countless hours of her time and a couple of tanks of gas. But she plans to keep it going beyond this year, beyond this pandemic. For Here and Now, I'm Sonia Doctorian in Lafayette, Colorado.
NPR is remembering people who have died of coronavirus, including essential workers like grocery store clerks, mail carriers, and healthcare workers. We'd like to hear a story from you about a loved one you've lost to COVID-19. Head to npr.org/frontlineworkers to share a memory. As we all wait for governors and mayors to say it's time to open things up again, our next guest says they're not the ones with the power. We are. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. His article is called "It's the Pandemic, Stupid." Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, what do you mean when you say it's the pandemic, stupid?
So I think there's this model that a lot of people have in their heads that Americans are staying home because the government told them to. But it's actually the exact opposite. Across the country, it was the government that followed the public. In every single state, most of the increase in people staying at home actually happened before the governors issued their stay-at-home order. And that's because in the days before all these state lockdowns started, the public was hit with all this terrifying news about the virus. You had the Dow plunging, the Italy lockdown, the NBA canceled its season, Tom Hanks was diagnosed with COVID. Mm-hmm. And so the American lockdown was not state-issued. It was information-based, and the states followed the public.
And there's actually some research that bears this out. You point to a team of economists at Harvard. What did they find?
Right. So the Opportunity Insights team based at Harvard University used this data from a bunch of different private businesses like credit card processors and payroll firms. And they built this really extraordinary database of Americans' spending behavior and employment and a bunch of other economic factors. And this essentially allowed them to get a kind of daily temperature read on the U.S. economy. And what their data shows going back to March is just what I said, that this really stark decline in economic activity happened in the middle of March before most of these states were actually shut down. And I think this is really important because it shows that the shutdowns are not a political phenomenon. It's not like governors or the president have this light switch that they can flip on and off. This is a biological phenomenon. And so that's why it is, in fact, the pandemic, stupid, that's causing this terrible crisis that we're seeing across the country.
You know, another aspect of this that I think is worth pointing out is that even if businesses were to reopen, if schools don't reopen, then parents may not be able to go back to work, which will hold up the economic recovery even more.
That's exactly the point that I think most people should take away from these economic conclusions. The public is going to have a mind of its own. You're going to see some people in some states defy lockdowns and stay-at-home orders, and they're going to go out and do whatever they want. And then in other states, like maybe Georgia and some other states in the South, you could see a couple businesses open their doors, but a lot of people not actually come back to those businesses and shop there or eat there or dine there. I just think it's really important to remember when we look at the economic devastation that this pandemic pandemic has caused for the U.S., it's not as if that devastation was the result of politicians flipping the switch in the economy. The devastation was biological in nature. It's people who are terrified of getting sick or getting their loved ones and friends sick. In order to fix this, you need a biological solution. You need to persuade people that there is a plan to make sure that they will stay safe if they resume the economic activity they were participating in February.
Which means that the job for politicians at this point is basically to have the data to back it up when they try to coax people out of their lockdowns at home and say, come back out into the economy again.
That's exactly right. I'm seeing a lot of states that are, quote unquote, reopening their economies even as the number of daily cases is increasing there. I think that's a recipe for disaster. I think that's a recipe for reopening. These businesses then realize that they aren't making enough business, which means that they might have to shut down again and then reopen again and then shut down again. That's going to be a really, really difficult economic recovery where we're never going to see anything resembling a U-shaped recovery where we bounce right back up. It's going to be like a very long L where you have a bunch of false starts. I think we need to focus really, really seriously in coming up with a national solution, both on antivirals and vaccines, but also on things like lockdowns to make people feel comfortable that the state has a hold on the virus and then the economic recovery can follow suit.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And as we close out this hour, we want to take a minute to mark the passing of comedian Jerry Stiller. His death was announced today by his son, actor-director Ben Stiller. With his late wife, Anne Mira, Jerry Stiller formed the comic duo Stiller and Mira, appearing in radio commercials, nightclubs, and films in the 1960s and 70s. He was later known for his roles on the TV shows The King of Queens and, of course, Seinfeld. Here he is celebrating the holiday he made famous, Festivus, with what he called the airing of grievances.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it. You, Kroger, my son tells me your company stinks.
Oh, God.
Quiet, we'll get yours in a minute. Kroger, you couldn't smooth a silk sheet if you had a hot date with a babe. I lost my train of thought.
Jerry Stiller died of natural causes at the age of 92. And on a personal note, when I was a young producer at an NPR station for Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket, we were in the middle of one of our first pledge drives, begging for donations on the air. And who called in to support the station but Jerry Stiller? So thank you, Jerry Stiller, for supporting public radio and, more importantly, for all of the laughs. Here and Out is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.